So I thought I'd just tell a little bit about where Franklin comes from. You can fit about three Australias, and Australia's a huge continent, inside Africa. That's the first, you know, how big Africa is. And there's this big plate here, and another big plate here, and then they've been running into each other, and that formed this elevated, because all the lava flowed out from inside the earth and formed these high plateaus right down through here, and these big lakes where the two plates on the earth plates clashing, massively deep, Lake Victoria, Lake Tanganyika, Lake Malawi, whatever it is. This Zambia and Zimbabwe used to be called Rhodesia, North and South Rhodesia. And there's a huge river that flows out here, Victoria Falls is up the headwaters of it. And that's the Zambezi. It runs out at the sea there, runs out on the coast. And a tributary to a northern tributary to the Zambezi is the Kafue River. And you can see it, that's it there, it goes around into there. So that's the Zambezi, that's the Kafue, and it goes a big hook like that. And it goes up into this volcanic plateau, which is, a lot of this plateau is nearly as high as Kosciuszko. And so it's, when you're at, even though you're on the equator, when you're in Nairobi, in Kenya, it's relatively cool. And the light there is, there's thinner air. People often comment when they go to, that there's something about the light there, because it's thinner air, it's so, the blue's so blue. And it really is amazing, Africa, when you go in there and you know you've been there before. You've got this huge memory of having lived some through, all the fossils have been found up through here, Lake Tankana, even down South Africa, right through here, early humans lived, which is our instinctive memory. And the bonobos live in the Congo River in that basin there, and gorillas in the common chimpanzees don't live south of the Congo River, only the bonobos, so they've got this one. And the Bushmen live down here in Namibia and Botswana in the Kalahari Desert. Vanderpost lived down here. So Franklin was born, Lusaka's there is the capital. That's it there. That's that blue there is that hook of the Kafue River. And the early explorers, some of them said that this is the most, thought that was the most fertile valley in Africa, because it's draining off this basalt plateau and it's very rich soil. And the Illa-speaking people. So that's the Kafue floodplain, with the Illa-speaking people's cattle on it. So it's a big, wide floodplain, very fertile. And they all lived in huts like that. That's the way everyone lived. So Franklin's uncle still lives in a village like that. So the chief would sit outside and he would take counsel with all the problems that are coming in, disputes and stuff. And the Illa-speaking people weren't discovered by Europeans until 1880. So that's the, so this is about the Illa-speaking people of Northern Rhodesia, which is now called Zambia. So that's the mighty Zambezi River, and that's the Kafue. And all the Illa, these are all Illa-speaking people around here. And that's the Ba'ila, which is the peoples that Franklin's part of, and his actual tribe is this one here, right in the middle, smack in the middle, called Nanwala.
Oh, that's the name of the village.
Oh, that's the name of the village.
Yeah, but it is there, yes.
So your tribe is the
Ba'ila.
Ba'ila.
Yeah.
So these are all Illa-speaking, but this is the Ba'ila. So they're living smack bag in the richest valley in Africa, which psychologically is interesting, because there were all these tribes trying to raid them because they had thousands of cattle, and they don't work their cattle, they don't use them for ploughing or anything. They know them by name, and they treasure them, and they milk them, and occasionally they'll eat one in a feast situation. But And they've got thousands of them. So some of the raiding tribes would come around and try to steal their cattle. And in one raid, they stole 40,000 head. So massive herds of cattle they had living in this place. And they're all warring between each other. So justice, the ultimate, you know, because once humans lived innocently and cooperatively, and there was enough love in society to heal any upset that started to emerge, right? For a long time, there was more love than upset. But at a certain point, it makes sense that upset got to a point where there was not enough love to heal it. At that point, it's on for young and old, because it's a case from there on, the arms race, who can get toughest quickest. So right around the world, whether you went to the Aztecs, because the Aztecs were a small tribe living in northern Mexico, and they were the first to realize, look, this trying to trust in everybody being loving and is over. You know, it's a case now who can be the most ruthless quickest. And they said, let's become a warrior nation. And they did. And they went and conquered all the tribes south, right down and took over Mexico. Same thing happened in the Midwest, in the Plains Indians of America. The Sioux were a small nation living along the Mississippi. And then they realized, they were the first to get the hang of this. Look, this is on for young and old. Whoever can get toughest quickest. So they determined to make themselves a warrior race. And so they selected for more and more toughness and all that sort of stuff and turned themselves into a warrior race. So it doesn't matter where you look around the world, there's this breakout of upset. And basically you can work it out that it must have happened at the advent of agriculture, which is something around 10,000 years ago. Because at 10,000 years ago, you start domesticating animals, domesticating crops, which allows you to live a sedentary life in villages, and suddenly upset's going to increase rapidly. And so we can guess that upset gets out of control and it's an arms race some 10,000 years, which is all fairly recent. So from 2 million years ago, when consciousness first appears, right up to only 20,000 years ago, it was really still love was still in the ascension, even though upset's increasing. And it was a matriarchal society, and so everything, all the really upset story happens in the last 10,000 years. It's the biggest, this arms race of all makes sense. It happened in the Central Europe, where you had those early tribes living along the Tigris, Euphrates River, and then up a Nile River, and you had all this sort of escalating battle. So and basically it developed into a war between the Aryan people that came from the steppes around the Caucasians from the north, and the Arabs or the Semitic races. It was the Semitic races. So they clashed in the middle there around Syria, and it got more and more ruthless. And one get more ruthless than the next, and so the first that formed the big civilization were in Turkey. What were they? Hittites, that's right. And they dominated that northern region. The Egyptians were dominating the southern region. Then they had a great war, and it was basically a draw. And they used diplomacy from there on to try to get along. But after a little while, the Syrians and other Assyrians, they all got more and more ruthless. Warlords came up and they amalgamated the people, and a great warlord emerges and just dominates everybody, you know, and they get more and more ruthless. So when the Hittites were reasonably ruthless, but the Syrians that came after them, you know, they would kill everybody in the city, and they would skin all their leaders, and they'd pile them all up outside the city gates, and they'd drape the skin of all their leaders over this pile of bodies as a warning, you know. So that's how horrible it all got, right? So now what we've got is the same situation happening down here. Because when the Boers landed in South Africa and started moving north, there was only Bushmen living in here. But the Bantu, their culture emerged here. So they were selecting for taller and bigger people and musical and athleticism and all that sort of stuff. And so they got their shit together and they became, so they started migrating down here. Then some of them went north around the southern Sahara, the sub-Saharan belt, and they melded with the, see, some of the early Egyptians were Bantu. They were dark-skinned, and so you get this Nilotic tribes coming down here that's infused with the Arab influence, and they're more warrior-like, and they were mostly cattle herders and stuff. And you can see they clashed here between the Hutu and the Tutsi. The Tutsi are Nilotic people, cattle raisers, and they were very tall, very arrogant. And the Hutu were mostly Bantu from come around this side of the Congo Basin, and they weren't, they're not as statuesque, and they're not, and so they, you get this huge war because the Hutu resented these people that believed they should rule over them, and then they had that huge bloodbath there, and I think the Tutsis are back in control, aren't they?
Yes, yeah.
So wherever you go, it's the same old battle that's happening. But what's interesting in terms of Franklin's story, if you read this book, you know, the same thing was happening down there. You're going to get more and more powerful warlords emerging. Like there's one guy, Sebetwane. He, at the age of 20, he attracted around him 30,000 warriors. He must have been very charismatic, very able, and he swept up from, he's actually not an Ila speaking, he's slightly south, somewhere along the Zambezi somewhere. And he started overpowering all these people around here and dominating them, you know. And Chaka was another great war chief that emerged amongst the Zulu nation down here in South Africa. And Chaka's technique for warfare, he had a short stabbing spear, and he'd have these impis which could run huge sort of regiments of his warriors, and they could run all day, and they actually destroyed a whole regiment of British, and then the British make a big song of the fact that they held them out at Rorke's Drift. One of the reasons given for why they didn't succeed at Rorke's Drift, even though they just wiped out a whole regiment of the Brits down here, Chaka's impis, was because Chaka had been sending impis up here to conquer all this region. And this guy, Sebetwane, and they managed, Sebetwane was a very clever general, wasn't he? He had all these tricks. And in one case, he stranded them on one side of the river or something and then killed them all. And only one warrior managed to get back to Chaka down here. And so he lost some of his best warriors in these wars that he was fighting up here. So when he sent all his impis against the Brits, he didn't have full contingent because some of them had been wiped out already by these earlier battles up here. So it's the same old story, you know, who can get toughest quickest. See, all this has been off limits because we've been told that we were once brutish and aggressive, not that our race was once innocent. So the whole thing's opened up. Once you just admit that we're once innocent and we got more and more upset, it all makes sense. So if you read chapter 8, it's the whole this amazing journey of the story of the increase of upset, you know, which has never been told before, never even admitted that we were once innocent as a race, as a human species. So it's very interesting that, and then the Europeans arrived, the missionaries arrived, which Franklin, you can understandably resented. They stopped that warfare and said that, you know, it's not godly and all this sort of stuff, and they put in administrators in there, Brits did, to try to control, and so these books are actually researched in the 1920s by, I think, a missionary and a guy who was an administrator, and went round. It was a pretty detailed record of the whole, one of their fish traps and all this sort of stuff, and so it's the same old story of who can get toughest quickest. But if you stand back from that, what's interesting is that, see, The first in, it's in those letters in the correspondence with myself and Franklin, but in the first, the first Greeks, civilized, early civilization, they only selected shepherds to be their rulers. They didn't, they select prophets, innocents. The Old Testament of the Bible is only a collection of denial free thinkers that are rare when they emerge. They just went way and way. They didn't want their best tennis players or the strongest rulers. They just selected, they were innocent enough to recognize the importance of soundness. Nowadays, all we do is persecute prophets, truthful thinkers, and make their life a misery, which is their story when you get into it, because they're ships at sea that didn't resign. And so, but the early Greeks used to only select, for instance, but at a certain point you can see, it's the same story, you know, let's get tough, you know. The egomaniacs are saying, fuck you, little, you know, shepherds coming in and ruling over us, you know, where am I going to... So soon, very soon, you know, it was who could, you know, the most egocentric that win power. Then they introduced democracy and supposedly that's supposed to contain the tyrants, you know. But there was a time when everyone was innocent enough to allow innocence to rule, which makes sense. So now standing back from this situation... So these guys, the Bantu, only the Bantu came down from here, and some of them from around here, and the ones must have brought cattle down from there, because some of these Bantu down here are farmers, and some of them are graziers. These guys, the Illa-speaking people, have these huge herds of cattle, so they're graziers mostly, farmers, graziers, and so they must have brought the cattle down through here, like the Tutsi. They're sort of Nilotic people. And some Nilotic influence as well as Bantu influence from here, the Bantus from here. So the question is, they only just arrived. The Boers, as to who has right to South Africa, for example, in terms of ownership, the Bantu can't say that because the whites were there at the same time, arrived at the same time. It's the Bushmen that have prior ownership. Not the Bantu or the Europeans. The interesting thing from my mind's point of view is when you're at that early stage and you're still, there's not, everyone's not so upset that they're all power addicts and wanting to be who can be the most power addicted to grab the power, and they're still innocent enough to select their soundest people to rule them. You know, they're most able, genuinely able, not the most egocentric. There must have been a time here when everyone's trying to pinch your bit of land because you're sitting in the best bit of valley in Africa and all your cattle, and you can withstand these onslaughts, these raiding parties from all the neighbouring tribes, and you're still the dominant, you're still dominating. So the Illa, Franklin's people, are right smack in the middle, right? So by, you can work it out that they must have been amazingly resilient and courageous and whatever to defy all these people that are trying to pinch their land, you know. And if you think about it, and you're being under siege and everyone's attacking you and you're still relatively innocent, then the people you would elect as your leaders wouldn't be the most powerful like Julius Caesar or Alexander the Great, but be the soundest, like Manifest talks about early Greek. You know, the genuine leaders, the person that stood up and says, no, look, I can help. I'm imaginative enough, sound enough in myself to help in this desperate situation our tribe's in. So you'd get genuine leaders who are, so the chiefs, the line of chiefs would come, descend from possibly exceptionally individuals who were the born leaders in the sense of they were sound and secure and able. So, you know, we wonder at Franklin's amazing skills at the age of 6, learning college level reading books and stuff, and be able to play the piano like a dream. I mean, maybe he's from an exceptional line of chiefs that were selected because of their real quality. So there is, that's his village, right smack in the middle of the best part of Africa. It's amazing to think about it, you know, what we might have access to in Franklin. So he's a genuine leader of his people. And to have found this information and want his people, he's giving them the best leadership they've ever had. So out of the most obscure corner of the world, the first WTM centres, one of them has been set up by this chief from the heart of Africa. It's quite interesting to think about. I'm still getting to know Franklin, like he's getting to know us. Anyway, Franklin, by the way, was born. He's born up the top end of near the Congo border, Ndola. Ndola is a big town, and then he went from there to Kikwe, which is another big town up here, before ending up at Lusaka. And when he went and lived on the farm, so there's Lusaka there, there's Ndola, there's Kikwe, up on the edge of the Congo. So he born there, grew up there, but his tribe is from down here, on that bend in the Kafue River. So when Franklin was young, instead of going to university, he just went bush for a couple of years, and he went up to a farm up in here. And there's a missionary and stuff up there. So he's always had this didn't want to go and see the European countries like all these other African friends. He wanted to stay close to nature and disown all that rubbish. So, because he was an unresigned prophet. Well, that's something is that roughly right, Franklin?
Yes.
So this is a whole new discussion and description of our world.